This is the Voice of Freedom.
Good evening, godless sodomites.
It will be my privilege to disclose information which seldom levels down to ordinary channels and the general public.
Subliminal message. They are not paying attention to the message, but it is reaching them nevertheless.
It's a mental battle of wits.
There is no America. There is no democracy.
There is no West.
Government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
We're losing our freedom. And this isn't something that's going on far away. This isn't something that's happening places we can't do anything about it. It's happening right here.
History is made by determined minorities. One man's criminal is another man's freedom fighter.
It's just time for America to wake up.
The truth hurts.
Ask yourselves in all honesty, what on earth is wrong with the United States?
The Americans have lost the capacity to be indignant.
Burn that flag in protest.
While the popular mind has been poisoned by the lethal gas of propaganda,
hyped by the unrelenting.
That's when America was overdosed.
This is your brain. This is drugs. This is your brain on drugs. Any questions?
America's doomed.
We need to overthrow the government of the United States.
You can't do it unless you believe that you can do it.
Do you believe?
You believe?
I know I do.
This is the time.
What is the haps, Hap Cadets, Cats, and Kittens? Give me five on the black hand side. It's the Higgity Higgity host with the most, Moxie O'Brien, back again with another episode of Come and See here on another Friday morning in America. I needed to take a few days to collect myself after talking about conversion therapy, but we're back at it. Before we get into the episode today, though, as has become sort of customary on all of these, I'm going to talk a little bit at the beginning of the show. It's sort of an intro, if you will. So, the Pride stuff that we've been covering has been really it's been good for me to get into queer history, queer rights, queer liberation, things of that nature, because it's not something that I spend a lot of time studying, even though it is a very important part of my personal history. As we've discussed in the past, my introduction to fieldwork, street activism, things of that nature was gay rights, gay marriage equality, safe prom, gay straight alliance, things of that nature when I was in college. So a lot of what we're talking about relates to my introduction to activism. And I wanted to talk about how I got interested in being an activist in the first place. Now, it is worth mentioning that, like, these are ideas, the concept of progressive thinking, forward thinking, really left thinking, has kind of always been there with me to some extent. I discovered socialism fairly young. But I think music had as much to do with shaping my opinions and my identity as anything else did. And really, my introduction to politically minded music that resonated with me was hardcore. Bands like Morning Again, like Converge, like Race Traitor, like Remembering Never, all bands that through the weirdness of social media and internet presence have members who listen to this show now, something that blows my fucking mind periodically. Indecision, another one. And I think that at the top of that pile of bands that really started getting me to think about the issues, think about what things meant, analyze things. I know some people had to read Marx to learn that you should analyze things. I got into hardcore. Remembering Never's Women and Children Die First, that came out in 2003 or 2004, I think. And something about this record that I'd never seen before as a young person was all of the lyrics were printed for each song. That's not new. But there was like a paragraph and a half under the lyrics about why Pete wrote those songs and what they meant and what he was trying to say. And it got me interested in things like animal rights, veganism, something that I did for a while. I don't like to think of myself as a quitter, but I do enjoy a steak every now and again. What are you going to do? Thinking about religion in sort of an analytical and critical way. And that was formative for a young Moxie O'Brien to understand that you could start, there was actually a space to pick at things to try to understand why they were the way they were and how they got that way. And for that reason, the band Remembering Never has been very, very important to me since adolescence. And their vocalist, Pete Kowalski, died this week. And I've been struggling with grief about that, because this is a guy who had a lot to do with how I turned out. As a person who doesn't really have a father figure, you know, which being AMAB and having gone through foster care and adoption and placement and prison and all of those sorts of things, I've had a lot of facsimile fathers over the years. You know, I don't know mine at all, which is fine with me. I'm fucking almost 40. We're not gonna have a catch. But it's difficult to understand how you're supposed to do certain things without someone who's you're modeling yourself after, I think, or at least it was for me. Maybe that's the autism. I don't know. But I've had a lot of stand-in male role models in my life who were able to sort of give me the idea of this is how this works. And I suppose as a non-male identifying person, it's less of a big deal to me now that I have that. But as a young person who didn't understand what being a man meant, because I wasn't one, it was very important to me to have people to look to say this is what men do. And a lot of the problem that you have with that is that there aren't a lot of good male role models out there. You know, there's a lot of people who abuse their station to take advantage of other people who don't reckon with the power that comes with being a role model. And I think that's why it's really, really important not to pay a whole lot of attention to celebrities or look to them for ideas about how you're supposed to behave as a human being. But I've had a few that I was lucky enough to know in my personal life. Weirdly, all of them are dead now, which I guess is a thing that happens whenever you get to be about my age. That, you know, the dads die. I don't know. That seems to be a part of life where they go away and you become the you that you were always meant to be. I don't know how men romanticize the I become father scene from Hellboy. But Pete, as someone who I've looked up to for damn near 20 years of my life and had such a profound impact on my political, socio-political identity, this one hit me really, really hard and got me thinking about the importance of living a meaningful life versus living a long life. You know, Pete wasn't that much older than me. A lot of the role models that I've had as a young person, I'm now the age a lot of those people were when I met them, or in some cases older than they lived to be. The person who I think I give the most credit to for helping to raise me died at the age of 23. I'm 36. So it's difficult to look at that person's life in the context of I've lived almost 15 years longer than you ever got to, and the lessons that I could glean from you are sort of over with in many ways. And it's forced me to look at this show the in real life work that I do, the field work that I do, the defense training, things of that nature, and examine whether I am doing my level best to be the kind of person for other people that those people were for me. And I think that ultimately you can't know that because it's not up to you whether you have a profound effect on other people, but fuck, I hope somebody got something out of this mess. And that's something that I continue to not struggle with, but spend a lot of time thinking about as a person who expresses my thoughts and records them for a job. It's especially in the context of today's social media sphere, today's Hollywood, all of that shit, where somebody that millions of people look up to reveals themselves to be an absolute fuckwit monster, like every couple of days, Jonah Hill. And I just, when you lose someone who was able to have a positive impact on your life that was never dimmed by, oh, right, you were kind of a monster, it's difficult when you lose those people. That has nothing to do with today's episode at all whatsoever. It's just sometimes I have thoughts and I like to say them out loud and, well, you can't run away, so here we are. Today's episode of the show is not unrelated, I guess. We're talking about the Stonewall Riots, sort of the creation of the concept of gay pride, the pride movement, the shift that happened in public perception of gay identity and things of that nature in the wake of the riots, some of the riots that preceded Stonewall, because it wasn't the first. It was the biggest up to that point, but it wasn't the first. And we're also going to talk about Nat Turner. Because, fuck, in like 95 episodes of this goddamn show, I've referenced him probably well over 100 times. We've never really gone into detail about who he is or what the Turner Revolt was. And I think that there is a strong parallel between the Stonewall Riots and the Turner Slave Uprising in how they both changed public perception about a marginalized group. Because as we've discussed in the past with Nat Turner and the Turner Rebellion and the perception of white people about slaves and African Americans, the idea was we liked being treated the way we were being treated until they had to confront the reality that, well, if they like this so much, why do they keep cutting our fucking heads off? And with the Stonewall Riots, the perception that gay was something you should be ashamed of and try to hide about yourself, reinforced by a whole bunch of laws, which we're all also going to get into. If they're ashamed, why are they fighting the pigs? There's a real necessity to confront this idea that the public has that holds a marginalized group in a place of oppression when that group continues to start shit about it. And I think that that's an important lesson for all Americans to contextualize, because what it shows you is the opposite of what the media tells you, and that is that violence solves problems. That extraordinary violence, anger, destruction of private property, and fighting the pigs does actually accomplish goals, and one of them is force everyone to take you more seriously. So when the Young Turks tell you that what you need to do is shut the fuck up because you might lose an election if you tell people that you're tired of being treated like a second-class citizen, remember that in the case of Nat Turner, the Stonewall Riots, the feminist movement sending a whole lot of bombs to a lot of government offices and things of that nature, violence does actually work. And it does actually help you advance the conversation. And one of the components of that is they can't ignore you if you keep burning shit down. And I think that, well, those of you who've been listening to the show for a while are aware of my feelings about rioting and the destruction of private and government property. I can't necessarily go into detail about them because I don't want to go to prison again. But having said that, I think that it's important to look at Stonewall in that context because of what it tells us about... I almost said a dream deferred, but then I didn't because I felt like that would have been super fucking corny. But now I'm regretting that I didn't just say it, and I'm doing this weird meta monologue thing instead. So what happens to a dream deferred? And we could all just pretend like I didn't already do the thing that I just did. So there's a lot to get into in terms of the history of gay liberation, what gay rights were before Stonewall, and everything else. So I'm going to go ahead and get into the material. And that's it. That's all I got. Let's fucking get into it, shall we? Here we go.
Let's pick a topic, and then everyone goes around in a circle and says their feelings on that topic. I'm grateful that black people gave us rock and roll music. Lynyrd Skynyrd, ZZ Top, 38 Special, all those guys owe everything to black American folk and blues musicians. I mean, they wouldn't exist without them. And then white redneck music would just sound like, well, what it sounded like before black people, which was the wet, sloppy sounds of fucking your sister. Okay, so that's my turn. Which one of you dumb sister fucking tiki torch carrying sloth from the Goonies looking pieces of shit wants to go next?
That has nothing to do with the episode at all. I just really, really like that scene. Anyway, we've discussed on previous episodes that the ideas of male and female gender identity, as they're commonly understood in the West, are a component of colonialism and capitalism. Really, the need to create workers and taxpayers and the enforcement of patriarchy. As maintaining this status quo is important to the state, we've had laws enforcing it for centuries. In 1848, Columbus, Ohio instituted a dress code ordinance forbidding anyone from appearing in public, quote, in a dress not belonging to his or her sex, end quote. And over the next several years, similar dress code laws appeared in over 40 cities in the United States. Dubbed masquerade laws, or disguise laws in some places, these laws gave pigs an express mandate to go after the queer community, and they did. Records of statistics before the 980s are even hard to find. New York had a law against, quote, painting your face to disguise your identity in 1845. And in 1890, in San Francisco, where, by the way, only 8% of the founding population was female, laws restricting gender nonconformity started with commitment to asylum, as was the case with Mamie Dick Rubel. I'll get to that in a second. Dress itself wasn't targeted, but gender nonconformity was conflated with public indecency and prostitution. The Rubel story is particularly interesting to me. They went by Mamie and Dick interchangeably, and their court testimony was, quote, I'm neither a man nor a woman, and I've got no sex at all, end quote. In 1890, that got Mamie Dick sent to asylum for, quote, suffering from a hallucination that they should wear men's clothing, end quote. They died in asylum of tuberculosis after 18 years. Gender nonconformity sent thousands to asylum in the 19th and early 20th century. That, of course, gave way to the anti-dress, or three-article rule, which was used by pigs in raids or just to harass queer people. Essentially, the three article rule was a vice law that permitted pigs to arrest you for sexual deviancy if you weren't wearing three articles of clothing attributed to your assigned at birth gender. The three article law was never written down, so to speak, anywhere, so much as it was something that the queer community and the pigs knew about, and squares were blissfully unaware of. This cyclical relationship of harassment from pigs led to underground gathering spaces that allowed dancing and served alcohol, something that made gay clubs very popular and very lucrative during Prohibition. The queer club scene already had secret speakeasies with hooch on tap. That's right, I'm bringing hooch back. This further solidified the state's conflation of queerness and gender nonconformity with various vice laws, such as public indecency, public drunkenness, immoral performances, indecent exposure, and lewd behavior. As cities developed and expanded, the policing of queer spaces and queer visibility increased. Many of these masquerade and anti-dress laws remained in California and New York, for example, until the 1970s, and they resulted in countless arrests for entrapment and solicitation, essentially for looking queer in public. Additionally, newspapers would frequently print the names of those who'd been arrested, outing them to the public and potentially destroying their lives and reputations. Several people arrested for violating public decency laws found themselves deported. And of course, we've discussed the Lavender Scare on the show in the past. While some aspects of dress laws loosened over time, for example, feminists used to be targeted by the pigs for wearing pants for decades, other elements of it were still being used as recently as 2011. These 19th century laws allowed for intense policing of the queer community in the 1940s and 50s when raids on queer bars resulted in mass arrests for violation of cross-dressing and public decency laws. In 1944, Detroit went so far as to amend its ban on cross-dressing to include private premises as well as public spaces, making it illegal to dress in a way deemed inappropriate by the state in your own fucking house. In 1952, Miami passed a law banning, quote, female impersonator performances, a thing that, interestingly enough, they're trying to do again as we speak. And we discussed back in the episode on censorship that reading material related to homosexuality fell under the purview of obscenity and wouldn't be mailed in some cases. This was an issue with One Ink in the 1950s. One Ink rose out of the homophile movement, which we'll discuss in a minute. In 1953, One Ink began publishing a monthly magazine called One, a pro-gay publication that sold for 25 cents apiece. In 1954, the United States Post Office Department declared the magazine obscene and refused to deliver it. As a result, One Ink brought the matter to the Supreme Court, challenging obscenity laws on First Amendment grounds in regards to pro-homosexual writing. One had been targeted by the FBI via the Post Office Department as lewd, lascivious, and filthy, and therefore unmailable under the Comstock laws, which you'll remember we discussed back in the censorship episode. The post office claimed that stories in the magazine were, quote, lustfully stimulating to the average homosexual reader, end quote, and may, quote, direct the reader to other obscene material, end quote. I mean, we could only hope so. The court upheld the post office's decision twice, so the matter was finally brought to the Supreme Court in 1957, who sided with One Inc., citing Roth v. United States. This was the first Supreme Court ruling dealing with homosexuality and how free speech rights affected gay rights. For the queer community, this was binding legal decision that the queer lifestyle no longer constituted legal obscenity. One Inc. was part of what's known as the homophile movement. The homophile movement was a sort of collective of organizations and publications that supported sexual minorities around the world in the 1950s and 60s. The homophiles were really the first out and semi-public pro-gay voices after World War II had really sent the culture underground. One of the more prominent American homophile organizations was the Mattachine Society, which was founded in Los Angeles by Harry Hay, a complicated communist and labor organizer who we'll discuss at length here because you sort of have to unpack Harry. Hay was prominent within the CPUSA and the pre-Stonewall gay queer rights spaces. It's hard to say because it referenced everywhere that I did research listed as he, but Harry considered Harry to be gender fluid and really pushed for recognition for those who didn't conform to a male or a female identity. Harry actually helped bring white attention to the native concept of being two-spirit, or as he called it, bear dash. The idea of occupying more than one gender within a single body, right? So there's a lot of important work surrounding Harry Hay that before Stonewall and sort of the general radicalization and adoption of gay pride, Hay was a very important sociopolitical theorist within the homophile movement of the 50s and 60s. Now, he's a complicated figure because in his, I guess we'd call it later career because he died in 2000 at the age of 90. He sort of drifted away from the broader queer community and began to endorse NAMBLA, the North American Man-Boy Love Association. Their pederasty advocacy group. I don't know that they're widely operational at this point. I know they no longer have meetings, but Harry was sort of one of the early proponents of the idea that pedophilia should be included within the umbrella of queerness. And when he was denied that recognition, he boycotted subsequent prides beginning in the late 70s. So in that, you sort of have this recognition that someone who was important to the movement and to the cause of queer rights and queer liberation was still able to have their place at the table revoked when what they represented became at cross purposes with what the movement was about. So the conversation that you have so frequently these days about minor attracted persons, or whether or not pedophilia is part of the queer community, or the dog whistles surrounding drag story hour, things of that nature. One of the most prominent voices in gay rights in the 50s and 60s was an advocate for that and was sort of surreptitiously removed from the movement as a result, and died without that becoming part of the broader queer umbrella. So Harry is complicated because there's so much debate and discourse and bad faith conversation about pedophilia being an aspect of homosexuality, and this prominent figure within the movement believed that and was expressing that. I mean, he spoke at 4 NAMBLA rallies and offered to bankroll the PR department, and actually suggested perhaps they should change the name because it was bad for their public image. I think the idea that they were advocating for pedophilia was what was bad for the public image, but what do I know? So, Harry was, before Stonewall really transformed what gay rights meant, I think in a broader sense, Harry was a figure that did a lot in advancing the conversation and the ways gender was looked at. And I think that it's important to understand that while the dude was clearly a piece of shit and had some very wrong-minded ideas, and I don't think that he's someone that we should venerate or memorialize, thoughts he had were important to the movement. And I think that's important because we have a lot of trouble on the left, especially, I think, particularly those of us who spend a lot of time on the internet. I'm not pointing any fingers because you're all technically on the internet right now. That we have difficulty understanding that it's possible for people to contain multitudes, that it's possible for an individual. We did an episode about Fred Phelps a couple of weeks ago, and it's difficult to contextualize that this figure, who was virulently homophobic, anti-Semitic, Islamophobic, was also a civil rights lawyer and had NAACP awards. Harry Hay was an important figure in the gay rights movement, particularly in the United States of America. He was also a pedophile. Both of those things are true. And I think that you can recognize that he brought attention to things like gender fluidity, particularly in the white queer community, because a lot of the ideas that I think you'll find that Harry was calling attention to were already kind of culturally accepted in non-white groups. I've hammered into the listener since the episode on colonialism that a lot of these ideas that we look at as deviations from the norm, before colonialism, they weren't deviations. This was all normal. What you're experiencing now is the deviation, and it's why you feel like you're losing your fucking mind all of the time. These things that we now have to have these vanguard social movements to insert into the public consciousness used to be normal. And I think that's the most frustrating thing about all of this, is that you now have to have a protracted debate every couple of hours to justify your existence to people who stole the historical record from you that proves that the thing you are was normal in the first place. And that's why being proud is important, because for such a long time, the gay and queer identity, the nonconformist identity, was considered deviant, a deviation different from the norm and not just another thing you can do. And that's psychologically damaged probably hundreds of millions of people for centuries. So while it's important to look at someone like Harry, that's right, we're still talking about Harry, and say that he brought a lot of the Harry's pronouns were not made specific to me. I think that it's important to note the things that Harry brought to the discussion. They weren't Harry's ideas. And so you don't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater, as Granddad used to say. You can look at the ideas and the way that they advanced the conversation while recognizing that the person who said them might have been a fuckwit. And I think that that is a level of nuance missing from a lot of our conversations about historical figures, particularly left-leaning historical figures, that it's okay, well, not okay, but that Martin Luther King can both have been a an influential figure and fucked around on his wife. Malcolm can have been an influential figure and also probably most likely believed that white people were invented in a lab by a big-headed man named Yacoub. There's a lot of room for people to, as I said, contain multitudes. And I'll get off my soapbox and get back to the script now. So, Harry co-founded the Mattachine Society with Frank Kameny, an astronomer and gay rights activist from Washington, D.C. The homophiles and pre-Stonewall queer community didn't really advocate for or place emphasis on coming out. Much of the broader homophile movement took cues from Dr. King's nonviolent approach in the civil rights movement. Kameny attended the March on Washington in 1963 and was inspired by Black is Beautiful to coin Gay is Good. The Mattachine Society staged sit-ins and picket lines. Kameny also worked with Larry Kramer and ACT UP, using civil disobedience to bring attention to queer rights issues. Gay bars functioned as some of the only places where queer people were welcomed, and thus were subject to particularly heavy policing. In Los Angeles in the 1950s, it was illegal for a person's gender presentation not to match the gender shown on their ID. As such, many gay bars still banned transgender patrons. Arrests for homosexuality by the LAPD increased by 80% from the 1940s to the 1950s. As police brutality directed at the queer community increased, so did resistance to it. Stonewall wasn't the first riot of its kind. That distinction actually goes to the Cooper Donuts riot in 1959. As was typical at the time, police entered the Cooper Donuts and began checking IDs and making arrests, starting with two drag queens and adding a few sex workers and a young man who was out cruising to the list of arrested persons. The pigs were very aggressive with the people that they were arresting and attempted to cram five people into the back of a single patrol car. One of the arrested persons protested the treatment and refused to get into the car. As the pigs struggled with the arrested person, they were pelted with donuts, dirty coffee filters, garbage, and beer bottles until they fled the scene without making any arrests. The patrons of the donut shop and the surrounding community then took to the streets to celebrate. Police returned with reinforcements, but ultimately ended up blocking off the street until the revelers, or rioters, your preference really, calmed down. The Cooper's Donuts riot is widely considered to be the first gay uprising in American history, and it marked the beginning of a trend. By the 1960s, queer communities in urban areas were forming. This, of course, made queer people easier to harass, but that's just how othering works. you really started to see the first states abolish sodomy laws around this time. Illinois in 1961, and by 1962, the Model Penal Code recommended all states follow suit. By 2002, 40 of them had, and in 2003, the Supreme Court struck down sodomy laws nationwide in the case Lawrence v. Texas, ruling that private sexual conduct is protected by the liberty rights in the Due Process Clause of the Constitution. 20 years ago. In 1961, in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, at the Black Knight Tavern, a brawl broke out after four men, allegedly sailors, entered and caused a disturbance, refusing to show their IDs. See, gay bars at the time frequently checked IDs and actually kept a sign-in sheet. And these men didn't want to be identified as having been at a gay bar. A patron named Josie Carter beat one of these men over the head with a beer bottle. Her partner was the bouncer at the tavern at the time. The men then left the tavern, one of them to go to hospital. The others returned with reinforcements, declaring, "Come on, faggots, let's do this." To which apparently the whole bar responded, "All right." A fight between the queer patrons of the Black Knight Tavern and this group of drunken sailors ended up destroying most of the bar. Between 12 and 20 attackers fought 75 bar patrons and caused $20,000 in damages. Three people were hospitalized, one of whom was put in critical condition with a head injury, as many as 9 days after the fact. He may have died from sustained injuries, but it's actually unclear. In September 1964, in New York City, a gay rights activist named Randy Wicker organized a protest of the draft office for violating gay men's confidentiality with their draft records. Several acts of civil disobedience were organized by the Eastern Regional Conference of Homophile Organizations, or ECHO, in Philadelphia and New York in 1964 and 1965. In 1966, a riot broke out in San Francisco's Tenderloin District at Compton's Cafeteria when pigs attempted to arrest a trans woman. Trans rights were sort of a hot-button issue at the time, and, well, we've since figured that out, haven't we? The transsexual phenomenon, which was written by Harry Benjamin, who had treated Christine Jorgensen, had been released months before the riot, and Benjamin had opened a practice in San Francisco offering information on hormones and sex reassignment surgery. And many of the trans women involved in the riot were currently receiving treatment from Benjamin's clinic. Benjamin's book and his work sought to normalize and legitimize medical transition for trans patients. A trans man named Reed Erickson funded the establishment of more clinics through his Erickson Educational Foundation, an extension of One Inc. and part of the homophile umbrella. The Tenderloin was known for police corruption and survival sex work for many trans women seeking treatment at one of the nearby clinics. As being visibly trans was illegal due to anti-dress and public indecency laws, many gay bars didn't permit trans patrons, as their presence provided grounds for a raid and a shutdown. Most places wouldn't hire them either, so the area had a sizable, impoverished, and homeless trans community by the mid-1960s. The Compton's cafeteria chain, owned by Gene Compton, allowed trans patrons, and the chain served as sort of a meeting place for trans people in the Tenderloin District. Compton's cafeterias were also open 24 hours a day, making them ideal for the many homeless sex workers who couldn't go to gay bars. As such, staff at the restaurants would call the pigs and report patrons for female impersonation, a crime in California at the time. Even without the calls, pigs frequented Compton's because they knew they could harass and arrest the patrons there. In 1965, a group of queer and predominantly trans youth, many of whom were engaged in survival sex work, formed a group called Vanguard, which was widely regarded as the first gay youth organization in U.S. history. Founded by former priest Adrian Ravarore and activist and sex worker Billy Garrison, Vanguard utilized a dual approach of advocating for action and civil disobedience, but also peaceful coexistence with heterosexuals. Vanguard taught the ideas of Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi, and generally advised non-violent civil disobedience, but also the need to make space for oneself. Vanguard picketed the Compton's cafeteria for calling the pigs on their patrons, and many of the later rioters were members of the Vanguard organization. The Vanguard picket marked the first trans protest against police brutality. And after the protest, Compton's banned the Vanguard's members from the premises. 1 month after the picket and subsequent ban, a Compton's employee called police about trans women, quote, causing a ruckus. Police arrived and attempted to arrest a trans woman who then threw a cup of hot coffee in their faces. The rest of the trans patrons then attacked the pigs with cups and sugar dispensers, breaking the windows of the restaurant and chasing the pigs out into the street, beating them with purses and high-heeled shoes. The rioters then damaged the pigs' squad car and set fire to a sidewalk newsstand. Police reinforcements arrived with paddy wagons to perform mass arrests. The following day, trans and queer people showed up to the Comptons to protest, and when denied entry, they broke all of the newly replaced windows again. After this, Compton's business declined until the chain finally went under in 1972. The riot at Compton's galvanized LGBTQ plus activism in the Tenderloin moving forward, and while the event is somewhat lost to history, it marked a shift in perceptions from the straight community about the visibility and validity of queer rights, and within the queer community about its ideas concerning quiet coexistence. Violence often shifts public perception, and to that end, before we discuss the Stonewall riots, I want to talk about Nat Turner and the Southampton insurrection. Nat Turner was a preacher and a slave born around 1800 in Virginia. And in 1831, he led a slave uprising that killed 65 white slave owners. Nat Turner is sort of an insult to the man, really. Turner was his first master's last name, and that's also who named him Nat. When Benjamin Turner, his owner, died in 1810, his son Samuel inherited Nat as a slave. Nat was said to believe that he received visions from God, and also believed that he could interpret signs, and that God had made him a prophet. Nat was sold and separated from his wife and children when Samuel Turner died, and his visions intensified. Other slaves called Nat the Prophet, and eventually, even some whites began listening to him preach. After a series of 10 divine messages, Nat came to believe that God had ordained him for some great purpose. He later witnessed an eclipse that he viewed as a sign from God to lead an uprising. I mean, I guess whatever puts gas in the fucking car. The slaves communicated their plan to one another using songs that God had given the word to, quote, slay his enemies with their own weapons, end quote. The original date for the revolt was actually set to be July 4th, but Nat fell ill and plans were delayed until August 21st. Nat enlisted 70 freed and enslaved black people who traveled from house to house, killing every white person they found. To avoid attention, the rebels used knives, hatchets, and clubs, and they killed indiscriminately men, women, and children. This is actually where a lot of people who are familiar with the Turner Revolt get hung up on the Turner Revolt, in the idea that the slaves killed kids. My argument to you there is that this is a guy who was inherited by the children of his initial slave owner, and there is absolutely no historical evidence of any kind that the children of slave owners freed their slaves. There's all kinds of evidence available that they didn't, however. So it's dubious to me to say that the children of slave owners were children to the slaves and not just slave owners in training. Nat's orders were to, quote, kill all the white people, end quote, and to strike terror into the slave-owning class. They spared the homes and families of poor whites, focusing on those with money to own slaves. The uprising was eventually put down by Virginia state militia with reinforcements from the military and the state of North Carolina. The rebels were beheaded, and their heads were displayed on poles on Virginia State Route 658, which was dubbed Blackhead Signpost Road. As for Nat himself, his brain was removed and sent to be studied before he was boiled and had his fat sent to the families of the people who were killed in the uprising. He was skinned and dissected. His parts were kept as trophies, and his skin was used to make coin purses. To date, his skull is actually still on display at the Smithsonian, and the family is trying to have it submitted for DNA testing so that it can be released and buried with what's left of him at this point. Rumors of slave armies in Alabama and North Carolina began to circulate after the Turner Revolt, and white perception of slaves was forced to confront the harsh reality in the wake of the Southampton insurrection that there were very angry people out in those fields, and they didn't want to be slaves, such as the science of the day had suggested. That fear sparked a great deal of reactionary violence from slave owners, now looking at their workforces like potential armies in their backyards. Movement to send freed slaves back to Africa really picked up traction in the wake of the uprising, as fear over repeats of Nat's rebellion spread across the country. The revolt shifted the narrative around slavery and forced many whites to confront whether an ethical practice could elicit such a violent reaction. previous to the Turner Revolt, the general view was based on things like Samuel Cartwright's Diseases and Peculiarities of the Negro Race, that taught that the best treatment for a black person was to beat them periodically to show them who's boss, and remember that they're happiest whenever they're working. And that doesn't gel with, but these people picked up knives and just went down the street, house to house, slaughtering every white person that they could find, strictly to make a point, because they believed that, despite what we tell them the Bible says, God wanted them to kill all of the white people. So, what's science have to say about that, fake Dr. Cartwright? And in the same way, as we're going to discuss, well, not quite as violent, the Stonewall riots forced the straight community and the queer community itself to address how we reckon with queerness. Is it something that needs to be kept in a closet, a source of shame, a means of othering and isolation that we are forced to reckon with in sadness and misery forever? Or is this a part of our identity which should be exalted, that should cause us joy, that is part of who we are, that love is something that should have a positive reaction, not be a source of shame? And that might be something worth fighting pigs over. So now that we've gotten the slave revolt out of the way, sorry, that got a little bit messy, I understand. There's a lot of barbaric and savage behavior from slave owners whenever you go back to that time period. It's a shame that no one ever taught those people how to behave civilized. Anyway, let's get into Stonewall, but in order to set the table for Stonewall, let's talk a bit about Greenwich Village. I mentioned earlier that gay and queer communities really began to appear in the 1950s and 60s. And as a haven for artists, and really like the birthplace of the Beat Generation, Greenwich Village was one such queer community. Prominent gay figure and beatnik Allen Ginsberg frequented Greenwich Village, although he lived in Harlem when not attending Columbia University. New York City, like much of the rest of the country, still had anti-cross-dressing laws and laws against homosexuality that prohibited dancing in public and gender nonconformity. The Stonewall Inn, which was owned by the Mafia, was one of the only gay bars in New York that permitted same-sex dancing. The NYPD kept gay clubs largely in check through the use of what was called gayola, which was sort of a post-war bribery system. Liquor laws at the time prohibited bars from knowingly serving alcohol to gay patrons, so gay bars were forced to pay bribes to pigs to stay in operation. And this left most gay bars under the ownership of the Mafia. Many locations, like the Everard Bathhouse, for example, gained reputations as safe from police harassment because the pigs were also patrons. The Stonewall Inn, the ground zero for the riots, was technically two buildings, which allowed for a back room space for dancing, where lights could be flicked on to notify patrons in the event of a raid. Before it was a gay bar, the Stonewall had actually been a speakeasy throughout Prohibition and until 1966, when it was purchased by three members of the Genovese crime family to be operated as a gay bar. the mafia used gay bars to generate potential blackmail against wealthy and prominent closeted gay patrons, and sold protection and watered-down drinks to the underserved queer community. Alcohol was stored in a car down the street to avoid being confiscated in the event of a raid. The inn had no liquor license and operated as a private club that only admitted entry to noticeably queer patrons. No gay bars at the time were owned or operated by gay people, and as such, patrons were often treated poorly in gay establishments for being gay. All things considered, the Stonewall was kind of a fucking dump. It had no running water, and the glasses were dunked in a portable tub and redistributed. The drinking age at the time was 18, so young people frequented the Stonewall for gay dancing and drinks. The Stonewall also permitted drag and some cross-dressing in a back room that was designated for queens, and homeless youth living in nearby Christopher Park would frequent the inn for drinks as well. The weeks preceding the riots at the inn saw an increase in police raids that closed four other prominent gay bars in the area. The system of gayola was drying up, so the pigs had no need for gay bars. I mean, you can get a homeless gay teenager to blow you in your squad car, after all. Prior to the beginning of the riot, four undercover pigs entered the bar to gather evidence for the NYPD's Public Morals Squad, who carried out raids for violation of state liquor authority laws, such as knowingly serving alcohol to gay patrons. The undercovers gave signal, and backup was called using the payphone in the bar. No tip had been given that a raid was coming, and the staff and patrons alike were caught off guard. At 1:20 a.m., Saturday, June 28, 1969, four plainclothes pigs, two uniformed pigs, a detective and a deputy inspector arrived at the Stonewall Inn and announced that they were, quote, taking the place. 205 patrons were in attendance at the time, and standard procedure for police raids was for patrons to line up and for two female pigs to take all persons in women's clothing to the bathroom and check their genitalia for verification of sexual identity. So, try to picture this with me for a second. A time where the pigs could show up at a bar and take anyone in a dress into a bathroom to check their genitals to see if you were legally allowed to wear a dress or not. I believe it was Orwell who said that freedom looks a lot like bondage sometimes. Reports are that tensions escalated when some of the pigs began to assault and aggressively touch some of the lesbians who were in attendance. The pigs seized 28 cases of beer and 19 bottles of liquor, but the wagons that were there that were supposed to transport the alcohol hadn't actually arrived yet, so the patrons who had been arrested in the raid and all of the alcohol were forced to stand outside the inn for 15 minutes waiting to be taken to jail. The rest of the patrons, about 150 of them, rather than dispersing, formed a crowd and began to mock the pigs. When the paddy wagons arrived, the crowd began singing "We Shall Overcome" and jeering the pigs in a very hostile way. One of the pigs shoved a drag queen who hit him with her purse. The crowd began throwing pennies and bottles at the pigs as rumors that people being taken into custody had been beaten began to circulate. One woman in particular who was in custody broke free and fought four pigs for 10 minutes after being hit in the head with a baton for saying that her handcuffs were too tight. That woman, as accounts go, then turned to the crowd and asked, quote, "Why don't you do something?" before being thrown into a paddy wagon. And this is when the crowd got violent. The mob attempted to flip one of the paddy wagons, and the other police vehicles fled the scene immediately. This commotion drew more attention, and the crowd grew. People continued to throw change at the pigs before several of the rioters went and found loose bricks at a nearby construction site. By this point, the mob numbered between 500 and 600 people, and several of the pigs barricaded themselves inside the stone wall for safety. The mob hurled garbage cans, bricks, rocks, and trash at the stone wall, breaking all of the windows as rage over decades of mistreatment and marginalization finally exploded. A parking meter was uprooted and used as a battering ram on the doors of the inn. The crowd lit garbage on fire and threw it through the broken windows. Now, some people do report that the fire inside the bar was actually started by the pigs, but as the stone wall had no running water, there was no way to put it out once it got started. The initial riot lasted for 45 minutes before fire trucks arrived to put the fires out in the bar. It was at this point that the NYPD's Tactical Patrol Force, which is basically riot control, arrived to put the mob down and retrieve the pigs who had barricaded themselves inside the bar. Fights broke out between riot control and people who refused to be detained. Groups of transvestites fought the pigs in the streets, who were attempting to force the mob out of the street. The mob responded by forming a kick line and singing, quote, "We are the Stonewall Girls. We wear our hair in curls. We don't wear underwear. We show our pubic hair," end quote, to the tune of "Howdy Fucking Doody." The kick line was then attacked with nightsticks, which only infuriated the mob further. Though a prominent face of the riot, this is actually about the time that Marsha P. Johnson arrived at the inn. Johnson was a founding member of the Gay Liberation Front in the immediate wake of the riots, and would go on to model for Andy Warhol as part of Hot Peaches. She, along with Zazu Nova and Jackie Hormona, is most commonly associated with the Stonewall riots and helping to organize the crowd. The mob flipped a car to block off Christopher Street and then chased the pigs for several blocks. By 4 a.m., the police had been cleared out, 13 people had been arrested, and the Stonewall Inn had been wrecked and nearly burned down. The riot was covered in all of the New York newspapers the following day, and people came to Christopher Street to see the wreckage. That night, the rioting started again, this time with public displays of same-sex affection. The mob numbered in the thousands now, and fires and kick lines mocked the nearly 100 police from four precincts who could not quell the mob, who prevented the pigs from making any arrests. Rioting again died down around 4 a.m. on the second night, and Allen Ginsberg observed the second night of rioting and said that it was beautiful and, quote, "The guys have lost that wounded look that fags all had 10 years ago," end quote. Rioting continued sporadically over the next 2 days, and leaflets were distributed calling for an end to police brutality and the end of mob-run gay bars. The pamphlets called for gay ownership of gay spaces. This new militancy and visibility constituted a real split between the new direction of queer identity and the older members of the homophile movement, who were embarrassed by the new loud and proud identity seen at Stonewall. Negative coverage of the riot by the Village Voice resulted in another riot. Nearly 1,000 rioters descended on the offices of the magazine and threatened to burn it down before clashing with pigs yet again. The rioting on Christopher Street lasted for 6 days, but the implications were clear. A new gay identity, one that was unapologetically queer, had arrived. This new gay liberation movement was spearheaded by the Gay Liberation Front, which was founded in July of 1969, mere weeks after the Stonewall riots. The GLF held weekly protests at the Women's House of Detention in Greenwich Village, a women's prison called out for its abusive treatment of inmates by Audre Lorde and Angela Davis. The GLF helped to create the Purple Hand, a militant, gay, anti-police brutality force that was modeled on the mafia's Black Hand. The GLF began distributing Come Out, its first periodical, in November of 1969. The GLF also spawned the Lavender Menace, a similar lesbian activist group. The Third World Gay Revolution, a black and brown gay rights organization, and STAR, Street Transvestite Action Revolutionaries, also grew as offshoots of the GLF. The new liberated face of gay rights pushed for the removal of homosexuality as a diagnosed mental illness and created unprecedented visibility for gay rights and queer identity. Borrowing as much from militant black power groups as their predecessors had borrowed from black nonviolent student organizations, the GLF helped set the tone moving forward, even if the group itself only lasted for about 4 months. Former GLF members went on to found countless other gay liberation groups like the Gay Activist Alliance, who confronted politicians to end raids on gay bars in New York. The first Pride, or Christopher Street Liberation Day, was held on the 1-year anniversary of Stonewall, with sister celebrations in Los Angeles and Chicago. These constituted the first gay pride marches in U.S. history. The following year, marches occurred in Boston, Dallas, Milwaukee, Paris, London, West Berlin, and Stockholm. The New York march covered 51 blocks from Christopher Street to Central Park. Permits were only actually granted 2 hours before the march was scheduled to begin, but even so, the crowd spanned 15 city blocks. By 1972, Buffalo, Miami, Philadelphia, Detroit, Atlanta, and D.C. added pride marches in June. Now, almost every city in the country recognizes Pride with some kind of parade or revels, but the work remains. They found Marsha P. Johnson's body floating in the Hudson River in 1992. Though it was initially ruled a suicide, evidence suggests that she was murdered. And in 2002, her cause of death was amended from suicide to undetermined. As of 2016, her death was being investigated as an unsolved homicide after new evidence was uncovered. And the battle over trans rights and gender conformity now mirrors the time before Stonewall. This March, Tennessee passed legislation restricting, quote, adult cabaret performances in public or in the presence of children, and also passed another law banning transgender minors from receiving gender-affirming care, like puberty blockers, hormones, and surgeries. At least 9 GOP-led state legislatures are pushing similar anti-drag bills, punishable by a $2,500 fine and/or up to 1 year in prison. And on June 30th, the Supreme Court ruled that businesses can refuse service to LGBTQ+ customers if providing a service would violate the owner's religious beliefs. The court ruled 6-3 that businesses can refuse to serve us. So, Pride is important, but I think it's important as well to try to remember the rage that created it, because attempts to relegate queer people as second-class citizens are ongoing. In 1969, second-wave feminist Carol Hanisch popularized the phrase, "the personal is political." She framed it as a challenge to family values and the nuclear family. The idea is to question the boundaries of what is political and to reflect on how our lived experiences impact our perception of reality. The idea actually strikes me regularly as I grapple with the realization that, for example, food is political, that language is political, and especially as a queer person, sex is political. And our personal grievances have political causes and ramifications. It's difficult to conceive of a free country where the state security force marches you into the lavatory to lift up your skirt, where who you fuck dictates where you're allowed to go, and the government can arrest you for how you're dressed. Politics, therefore, has a power over the personal. The identity, the orientation, the ethnicity, these things exist within the political discourse, but they don't belong to the state. Nor does the state have input on them. Stonewall drastically shifted perceptions about the personal and the political, and it forced America to reckon with its queer population. In her 1969 essay, Hanisch wrote, quote, "One of the first things we discover in these groups is that personal problems are political problems. There are no personal solutions at this time. There is only collective action for a collective solution." End quote. And personally, I suggest that we move accordingly. So that's Stonewall and the establishment of Pride and the way that gay rights and queer activism evolved from 1969 moving forward to today, and why it's important to make note of that and keep doing the work. This was an interesting episode to do research on. I struggled for several hours about how to contextualize Harry Hay and whether I should go into what NAMBLA is, because it occurred to me that they're not really a prominent organization anymore, and most of the listeners, well, maybe not most, but a good chunk of the listeners probably don't know what NAMBLA is, and maybe that's fine. This is also an episode that I've been putting off for, well, about a year now, really. I've been wanting to cover the Stonewall riots since the Four Cornered Room, I think, actually. And it just was always, it always worked out that June was when I was on break. But fortunately, this year, this season just kind of keeps on fucking going, so I could hop right into it without much issue. I hope you learned something from this. And if you did, and you would like to show your appreciation, if you will, by throwing a few ducats my way so that I can feed myself and keep the lights on, and you would like to become a member of the illustrious and ever-growing Hep Cult, you can do so by going to www.patreon.com/comeandseepod. There's a few different options available as far as donations, everything from $1 to $20, single donation to monthly donations, and this is an entirely listener-funded operation until I start running ads, so your support is greatly appreciated. I also realized while I was working on this episode that I've never mentioned that links to both the Patreon and the merch store are in the description to every episode of the show. They're just hidden unless you click the little see more thing on the description on Spotify, for example, because Spotify hates the idea of paying me for my labor. So you can click the link in the episode description to find the Patreon page, or you can go to www.patreon.com/comeandseepod. And all subscribers to the show automatically receive a download link to the Uncle Bill mixtape, something that I put together in between seasons 3 and 4. That's, I think, 10 or 11 intros in the style of the opening of the show, specifically built around Bill Cooper and kind of Wu-Tang style-esque beats, for your morbid delectation, if you will. Also, all subscribers to the show are able to submit questions that I will answer in about a week and a half, I think, on the 100th episode of the show, because that's coming up really fucking quickly. So if you have anything you'd like to ask me, or likewise, any activist groups, community groups, things of that nature that you would like me to highlight on the show, drop us a line and it'll come out of my mouth on the air. If you would like to wear your support for the Come and See podcast, you can do so by going to comeandseemerch.bigcartel.com, also available in the link description to the episode, and there you can pick up one of the Come and See t-shirts. The first round of pre-orders for that have shipped out, the second round of pre-orders for that are about to ship out, and the third round of pre-orders will happen whenever that happens. I'm still working on a second shirt design. I am very, very, very far behind on everything clerically related to this show, because even though I use us and whatnot frequently whenever I describe this process, it is actually just little old me over here. Those are the businessy things, I believe. I think that's all of the money-related stuff. I know I said that I was going to start running ads in July, but I haven't recorded them yet, so you do have more ad-free content coming your way. We'll be back. Same Mox time, same Mox channel. On the next episode of the show, we are going to talk about the MOVE bombing, something that, like the Stonewall episode, I've been putting off covering for quite some time. So we're going to get into the MOVE bombing, and then after the MOVE bombing, I think we're going to talk about Rodney King and the LA riots. So we are, we're back on track here with some, it looks like the car is going in a particular direction again after like 2.5 months of me not really being sure what the fuck I was doing. So I think we're back on track with where the car is driving to. And we've got a few more surprises left this season, but the season is slowly but surely winding down. So enjoy it while it lasts before I take like 3 weeks off and start doing it all the fuck over again. But in the meantime, concentrate on the HEP, everybody. I have been Moxie O'Brien. This has been Come and See, and I will catch all of you HEP cats on the flip side. Smooches, deuces, dig it, Daddy-O.
God duped you into starting a war so he could punish you. It's almost 18 months now and the siege has got people eating their babies. You're gonna eat your babies, you jackass.
I'm finished.